Welcome to this RCGP podcast on lipids and cardiovascular disease. I'm Dr. Emma Nash, GP and e-learning fellow at the RCGP. Today, I'll be talking to Professor Derek Connolly. Thanks for joining us today, Derek.
It's great to be here.
Do you want to give us a bit of background on who you are and why you're interested in chatting to us today?
Sure. So I'm a cardiologist in Birmingham, where I'm also R&D director at Birmingham City Hospital, and I've been involved in a lot of the trials in cholesterol. But the proudest thing, Emma, is I'm on the Council of the Primary Care Cardiovascular Society. And obviously, like hypertension, we now have taken cholesterol into primary care. So I think being here today is incredibly useful.
Great. So we're very pleased to have you. So let's kick off with talking about lipid profiles. So obviously, GPs frequently request lipid profiles for their patients. What are the key points in interpretation?
So the first thing is, please do lipid profiles, because particularly during the pandemic, nobody was getting any blood tests. That's absolutely rational. But now that we're hopefully post-pandemic, it's important that patients know their numbers. We know their numbers. So make every contact count and please get everybody's lipid profile. Now, lipid profiles will vary around the country. And that's unfortunate in my humble opinion, but it's the reality. We all generally get total cholesterol, and that's all of cholesterol. We generally get HDL cholesterol, what we used to call good cholesterol. But interestingly, a high HDL, a very high HDL, is bad for you. It's a U-shaped curve. So we don't really call it good cholesterol anymore, but we get HDL. And that difference, total cholesterol minus HDL, we call non-HDL. And that is what a lot of places use. It might be in the next versions of the GP contract. And people worry about it because what is LDL? Well, LDL is the biggest subfraction of non-HDL. And it's actually quite easy to calculate LDL cholesterol. If the triglycerides are not significantly raised, you can simply use a calculation such as the Friedewald calculation. It's on MBCalc, it's on System 1 and EMIS, and you can see what the LDL cholesterol is. But many areas will measure it. Now, the other thing we're increasingly measuring is triglycerides. We can maybe talk about that in a while. And I suspect over the next 5 years, you'll see a rise in lipoprotein little a, LP little a. That is also independently a risk factor for heart disease. And almost certainly now we've got ways that we can reduce it. What we need to do, what we are doing at present, is the clinical trials to make sure that that has a benefit. It reduces heart attack, strokes, death. So that's a complete lipid profile I've described there. Don't just do a total cholesterol. Make sure at least you get an HDL so you can work out the non-HDL. And ideally, I'd like you to get triglycerides at least so you know that you can calculate LDL.
I understand that things have changed fairly recently about whether these should be fasting or not. Is that right?
We've already mentioned every contact counts. So I think for most patients, you get it when you can, like a blood pressure. However, if someone's got a raised triglyceride, we don't know whether that is a chronically raised triglyceride or whether it's because they've just had their enormous meal. So if someone's got a raised triglyceride, I will bring them back for a fasting sample. But to be honest, that's only about 1 in 10 patients. So for most patients, it makes massive sense to just get those figures into the database.
So if you've requested a lipid profile and then it comes back as being out of range or abnormal, what would the next steps be?
Well, the first thing is, and we can talk about this in a second, too low a cholesterol isn't something that we get bothered about anymore. Especially if they're on lipid lowering therapies, because that's what we're trying to do. So in the old days, we used to worry about too low cholesterol. We know that that's now safe, and therefore don't worry about that. But a high cholesterol, the goalposts are moving, and that's because we've done the clinical trials. And also remember, there's a difference between people who are primary prevention, maybe we can talk about that later, and people who are secondary prevention. That's people who've had heart attacks, strokes, who've got established cardiovascular disease. For instance, they've got a cardiac CT with atherosclerosis on it, or they've got a carotid ultrasound with atherosclerosis, or they've got peripheral arterial disease. And all of these, that established cardiovascular disease, we would now consider secondary prevention. And for them, in the European societies, the North American societies, and now NICE, we would want to get their cholesterol levels even lower. So the goalposts have moved as we've done trials and shown benefit, exactly the same as with blood pressure. We've been more stringent about what we think the LDL cholesterol the non-HDL cholesterol should be.
So when you get the result back, is there anything, what do we need to do in the first instance? Have we got to screen for anything else if this is the first time and it's a primary prevention sort of setting?
So if it's a primary prevention study, look at everything else. And you almost certainly will have an HbA1c. You'll almost certainly know the patient's BMI and their blood pressure and their kidney function. You'll probably know whether there's any family history of cardiovascular disease or whether there are other factors such as ethnicity. I work in Birmingham. And if you are Bengali or any other BAME, you may well have a different risk to a Caucasian population. That's really important. And of course, there are other diseases that we know increase the risk of cardiovascular disease, particularly inflammatory diseases like rheumatoid arthritis. So that is why we'd be keen that you use an atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease score. And I can tell you that the one we're going to be using next year almost certainly will be Q-Risk 3, which isn't on, to my knowledge, System 1 or EMIS yet, but is available on the internet. And I'm using that every day. But just watch this space. There are more. We might be moving towards lifetime risk as well, because that 5 or 10 year risk isn't really important for a 30-year-old, whereas a lifetime risk might be important. And therefore, I think there is going to be change going forward. But my betting, having seen some of the provisional documents, is we'll be using QRisk 3, the latest version of QRisk, from next year.
Yeah, absolutely. I understand that the NICE guidance is going to be changing in that direction soon. So if we've got a raised cholesterol or raised triglycerides, should we be screening for secondary causes?
It depends on the patient and it depends on the cholesterol level. I think for the vast majority of patients, if the liver function tests are normal, if they're not diabetic, if you've gone through an alcohol and dietary history and there isn't anything obvious, almost certainly this is real. And so a raised cholesterol is real. And interestingly, the thing that I ask these patients is there any history in your family, your aunts, your uncles, your grandparents, your mum and dad, of cardiovascular diseases? And you'll be amazed, the ones that come back with total cholesterols of 7, 8, pretty much all say, yep, everybody's got heart disease. And also watch, and this is particularly profound in my ear, those patients that have a very low HDL, maybe even 0.5, and yet the total cholesterol is only 5 or 6, they have really high risk because the ratios are important. And then that is a great motivator. And of course, that is another button in QRisk 3 that you can put it in and work out with the patient whether at this point in their life, whether they want to have lipid lowering based on what the statistics say.
Thinking about a raised cholesterol, when should we start thinking about familial hypercholesterolemia? You've talked about family history of cardiovascular disease. And also if we think, well, it's a bit lower than maybe where it should be for hypercholesterolemia, but it's, I don't know, 7 or 6.5 or something like that. Do we treat that?
So this is a really interesting concept. And the question is it a spectrum or is it a step change to familial hyperlipidemia? And of course, for the vast majority of patients, it's a spectrum. And therefore, risk is related. We have the Simon Broome criteria, and they are on EMIS and System 1. And you can work out whether your patient makes those criteria quite easily. And I would recommend you do that. But the truth is, the line is linear. And so we know that the higher your cholesterol, the more likely you are to have a cardiovascular event. And therefore, it's about proportionality. So even if they don't make the criteria for referral to a specialist lipidologist, the vast majority of patients these days, the truth is we can probably manage them, but the ones where we want to sequence them, the ones where we want to know the genetics, and maybe in the future, that's going to be pretty much everybody. And I think the Human Biobank program in the UK has been one of the global successes in telling us about the genetics of lipids. My friend Bob Giuliano at Harvard has just published some data saying in younger patients, about 30% of the risk of cardiovascular disease might be due to genetics, particularly of cholesterol. So we know it's an important component in everything, but so is lifestyle. And we'll talk about that in a second. So I think use the Simon Broome criteria, but if you've got a young patient with a high cholesterol with a strong family history of heart disease, either treat them or seek advice from your local lipidologist or diabetologist or cardiologist that's interested in cardiovascular risk.
Fantastic. So a new pathway has been published for lipid management. Can you tell us the key points to primary care as part of that pathway?
For sure. It's actually been published a couple of years and it's been changed already because the science keeps changing. But my friend Rani Khatib in Liverpool, and his team have done a fantastic job. It's a complicated poster, but it is a poster. You can print it out. You can get it online easily. It can be laminated, and it's a simple guide to using lipid lowering therapy. And the thing that I want to get over to you, and the thing that we're about to publish in the Santorini study, which we did around Europe, is that the only ways that for the majority of patients, particularly in established cardiovascular disease, that you're going to reach those lower targets we have for established cardiovascular disease is combinations of therapies, Emma. It looks like for a lot of patients, combination therapy is going to be the way forward. And that's what that document says. It says, do this. If this doesn't work, add this. Not swap it, add it. Exactly the same as we do with hypertension. And of course, the algorithms are different, although they use the same tools, different between primary and secondary prevention.
You mentioned targets. Should we be looking at measuring percentage reduction, or should we be looking at absolute numbers?
Okay, well, this is slightly controversial. I think that's fair to say. Certainly in the clinical trials, we had absolute targets. There is the old adage of 40%. Europe says 50%. The UK has said 40%. In some ways, I think the European way of at least 50% is doable. Now, when you think about it, atorvastatin 40 and 80 milligrams, most prescribed drug in the UK, 55 million prescriptions a year. They'll lower your cholesterol by more than 50%. So you've got someone on 40 or 80 of atorva, then you're going to get a 50% reduction. Now, ezetimibe, which is stage two, ezetimibe costs £20 a year now as well. It's cheap as chips. We've got the evidence from the IMPROVE IT study, and it lowers your cholesterol by another 15 to 20%. So you're getting a 65, 70% reduction in LDL cholesterol with two tablets that cost the NHS about £40 per year. You can see why there are all these new movements towards persuading people to go even further. Lipid-lowering therapies are the most prescribed drugs in primary care in the UK. And yet NHS England, and I'm sure my friends in the devolved nations would agree with this, are now pushing the idea of getting even further, particularly with those patients that don't attain or achieve the sorts of levels that we would like with a statin or can't tolerate higher doses of the statin. Of course, that is why in the old days when we only had statins, fire and forget was the right thing to do. But now we have five nice recommended ways of lowering LDL cholesterol, five different ways. So we have something for everyone, even the people that can't tolerate statins. And of course, if someone's blood pressure was 180 systolic and they couldn't tolerate even 5 milligrams of amlodipine because of ankle swelling, you wouldn't not give them another drug. You'd want to give them something else. And of course, that is where we're going with LDL cholesterol reduction. And the evidence keeps coming in. We know the headline results of the study with bempedoic acid. Bempedoic acid blocks cholesterol synthesis at a different point from simvastatin. But we know that the trial, the outcomes trial, the CLEAR Outcomes is positive. But this is already NICE recommended. It's an option, particularly if you use it with ezetimibe. And bempedoic acid and ezetimibe will lower your cholesterol by around 40%, which is kind of where I'd suspect the upgraded targets might be, for instance, in QUAF or DES next year. We'll see what happens.
Great. Okay. So you mentioned three of these five options.
So let's go through them. Everybody knows statins. They think they know statins. But remember, the easiest thing you can do in your practice is to press a button and work out who's on simvastatin and pravastatin and swap them to atorvastatin or rosuvastatin. This is the official policy. And it's cheaper. It's safer. It's more effective. In fact, there is interesting studies. There was a study many years ago using pravastatin versus atorvastatin called PROVE IT. And it was sponsored by the makers of pravastatin at the time. Both drugs were on patent. They're both generic now. And it showed that atorvastatin completely swept the floor with pravastatin. You can go and read the data yourself. And we've also done studies of the TNT study, 2005. Which we took everybody who could tolerate 10 milligrams of atorvastatin, and then we gave them 10 or 80, one of the two. And again, 80 swept the floor with 10 milligrams. So our viewpoint now, and it's on Rani Khatib's document, is for the majority of patients, you want to be using atorvastatin or rosuvastatin for primary prevention, at least 20 milligrams of atorvastatin, going higher if they tolerate, it's fine. And rosuvastatin as well is an alternative, particularly for people, for instance, who get a rash or some other side effects. Now, that works on an enzyme called HMG-CoA reductase, which is in the liver and in the muscles, and it's very effective. We've said that you can get about a 55% reduction in LDL cholesterol. But you and I know, in the real world, some patients either can't tolerate statin, and there's a great piece that Rani's produced in these guidance about statin intolerance, or they won't take a statin. And in those cases, and NICE is very clear about who this is, you can potentially use bempedoic acid. Now, bempedoic acid blocks synthesis of cholesterol only, we think, in the liver, a couple of levels above HMG-CoA reductase and an enzyme called ACL. And I've got lots of patients on bempedoic acid. It seems to have very low side effects. But what NICE would like you to do, what I would like you to do, is to give it in a single tablet, combination tablet, with ezetimibe. It's the same price. The ezetimibe comes free. And there you get that symbiosis. You get the ezetimibe blocking absorption. You get the bempedoic acid blocking synthesis. And you get around a 38 to 40% reduction in LDL cholesterol with no statins. So that is definitely a NICE recommended alternative to statins in primary prevention in patients who can't tolerate statins. But, you know, if it were me, I would take a statin simply because that's where the evidence is. And most of the patients we have, and we have millions of patients now in clinical trials, most of the patients have been on statin therapy. But you wouldn't leave someone with a blood pressure of 180 without amlodipine. If they couldn't tolerate amlodipine, you give them something else. Exactly the same is true of bempedoic acid. So that's given us a big option in primary prevention. Now, the other two therapies we have relate to a protein called PCSK9. If you think about familial hypercholesterolemia, FH, most of the patients with FH will have abnormalities surrounding the LDL receptor. We know that most patients with familial hyperlipidemia will have abnormalities of that LDL receptor. And of course, if you've got a gene from your one parent, you've got heterozygous familial hyperlipidemia, and that LDL receptor isn't produced, then you have higher cholesterol levels. But of course, the worst thing to have is genes from both parents, homozygous familial hyperlipidemia. If both your LDL receptor genes don't work, you don't have very good LDL receptors, then you don't get clearance of the LDL. And I liken it to when our famous bin men go on strike, the rubbish accumulates in the streets. If you have no LDL receptors getting rid of the rubbish, the total cholesterol increases. And so we knew that. But we also knew there were some patients who had high cholesterols, familial hypercholesterolemia, but had normal LDL receptors when sequenced. And the French-Canadian group found this protein called PCSK9. And we know what happens is PCSK9 binds to LDL receptors. So when the LDL receptor is internalized, holding the LDL, if it's got a PCSK9 protein bound to it, as well as getting rid of the LDL, the liver gets rid of the LDL receptor. So you have lower amounts of LDL receptor. And we think that's responsible in many areas of the world for heart disease. Now, we think that reducing that would be a great target to reduce LDL cholesterol. And we've done lots of studies. We've done studies with monoclonal antibodies. We did a study in acute coronary syndromes using an antibody called alirocumab, and that showed a big reduction in major adverse cardiovascular events, including a nominal reduction in mortality. And we showed in stable coronary patients in Fourier, and I was an investigator in Fourier, that again, you showed about a 15% reduction in events. And that was on top of the statin therapy, and some patients had ezetimibe. Now, interestingly, the Fourier study had an open label extension. So everybody went from half of them on placebo, half of them on active, to everybody on active. And at the end of a total of average of 5 years, with patients out to 8 years, there was a difference in cardiovascular mortality shown. Remember, it takes a while to stabilize plaques. We know that. In Fourier, the benefits in year two and three were much bigger than the benefits in year one. So that is an obvious thing to do. So these antibodies exist. Unfortunately, they're very expensive. And so NICE, in the wisdom, said we could only use it realistically for patients with LDL cholesterols above 3.5, despite statin therapy, and maybe 4. But it is useful in those patients with familial hyperlipidemia we've talked about. Now, another way, of course, of changing a protein, instead of blocking the protein once it's been produced, another way would be to stop the protein being synthesized. We all know we have DNA and it's transcribed into mRNA and it's translated into proteins. So what if we gave a small interfering RNA that blocked the production of a specific protein? And the first one that's come to the mass market is called inclisiran, and that's a small interfering RNA for PCSK9. And the beauty of that is that when you give an injection, it lasts 6 months. From all the data we have from the studies, we're not seeing any major adverse events. When you think about the adverse events, albeit small, that we saw with statins, less with ezetimibe, much less with PCSK9 monoclonal antibodies. And again, that so far, that's been replicated with PCSK9. But the bottom line is this is now available. It's available in secondary care, but it's available very much in primary care, and it's being given a lot in primary care. The injection you can order online, it costs £45. You're reimbursed £55. So there's a £10 tariff effectively going to the practice. And if you're given a vaccine, you can give an inclisiran injection. It's very similar indeed. So that's there as well. So to reiterate, we've got statins. Please use atorvastatin and rosuvastatin. We have ezetimibe, which is now cheap as chips. It used to be expensive. It is very cheap. It is very recommended by NICE. We've got bempedoic acid, which we can use in combination with ezetimibe as a single tablet, inpatient, NICE recommended, particularly for those that are statin intolerant. Now we have inclisiran. Inclisiran can only be given for established cardiovascular disease, can only be given if your LDL cholesterol, in spite of therapy, maximal tolerated therapy is 2.6 or above. But that is significantly less than the 3.5 that you have to be, or maybe even in some patients, 4 that you have to be for the monoclonal antibodies. But that's quite revolutionary. When you think, it feels like yesterday and we only had statins and now we have those 5 therapies.
Brilliant. That's absolutely fascinating stuff. Thank you, Derek. Just got a couple more quick questions for you on a practical kind of level. So first of all is, when you've started somebody on some medication, how long do you tend to leave it before you saying that it's working or it's not working?
That's a brilliant question. And in the old days, we used to leave it 3 months. But when we did the clinical trials, we found that most of the patients, the therapies start working almost immediately. And in the clinical trials, we found certainly by 3 or 4 weeks, most of them are at target. And certainly by 6 weeks, they are at target. So the old days of waiting 3 months have gone. I generally wait a month to 6 weeks. And then I repeat the LDL. And that's the point where I can make decisions.
So talking about initiating statins for primary prevention particularly, is there an age that you would not prescribe them beyond, or is there an age where you would stop prescribing them?
It's a brilliant question. Firstly, let's think about the patients who have established cardiovascular disease. And there, one of the ironies is that their risk of cardiovascular events is ginormous, particularly as they grow older. And therefore, those patients that are over 80 that have established cardiovascular disease, absolutely, 100%, I'm going to be giving lipid lowering because the absolute risk reduction and the number needed to treat is really relatively small. And of course, strokes, for instance, are incredibly expensive for the NHS. We've seen a big reduction in atrial fibrillation-related strokes with the advent of the DOACs. And very well done to everybody. Keep finding EF, keep treating people. But in established cardiovascular disease, I do see people stopping statins. I would prefer for you not to do that. Primary prevention, I think, is completely different. And the problem you've got there is the unknown unknown. So without testing someone, you really don't know whether they've got cardiovascular disease or not. And so I'm not saying we screen all the 80-year-olds for cardiovascular disease. Now, if someone's got dementia, and remember, lipid lowering, we think may well reduce dementia. That's an interesting concept, isn't it? But if someone's got dementia, if someone's got a life-threatening illness, I do stop statins in people who I think it is appropriate to do. But I don't stop it in established cardiovascular disease if they don't have another reason to die.
So one last thing, do you have any other top tips for GPs in the assessment and management of lipids in primary care?
For sure. And the simple top tip is measure the lipid profile and don't be frightened about it, because the truth is, measure your own. Measure your own, measure your relatives' own, get them measured. Get maybe an Lp(a) measured. And, you know, we're all about one person away from someone in our family with cardiovascular disease.
I think that's all we've got time for today. So I'd like to say a really big thank you to Professor Derek Connolly for joining us to discuss lipids and cardiovascular disease. Thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed this RCGP podcast, then please have a look at the e-learning website to find others on a variety of subjects. Goodbye.